for a better week.
Yeah, amen. Okay, this is the final class of our parenting paradigms for tweens and teens, number 4. So I want to do a review of our tools that we talked about so far. We're going to add in some more. So some of the tools we talked about so far are just having your own mantras. This is one of mine, but it's good to create your own sentences when you need them. Educate, don't berate. That happens to be one that worked well for me. Another one that I didn't put on here because it was just my self-talk, that with a chocolate kiss, they will grow up, they will grow up, they will grow up. Helped me get through many years.
Chocolate kiss what?
A chocolate kiss.
Stress release.
That's a stress release, right? And then just telling myself that they will actually grow up.
It's 2 shell pans.
Right. Oh, so that's in there.
You eat the chocolate again.
Yes. Okay. Skip step 2. We talked about at length. Ayin tova. So an ayin tova as opposed to an ayin hara. Right? Ayin hara is when somebody has an evil eye on you. That's ra. Right? The opposite of ra is tov. Ayin is feminine, so it's ayin tova, not ayin tov, like ayin ra. You can't really tell because it's an ayin at the end of the word ra if it's a hey or an alf, but it's a soft sound. Anyway, ayin tova. So seeing, there you go. So an ayin tova, so we talked about what that is, and we talked about Adam as the paradigm for that, seeing potential in people, looking in them and seeing potential. And one of the things that I talked about, I think in this class was just seeing the adult in the child and thinking about babysitting for that adult, that you see the grown-up that's there, right? And that's who you're babysitting for. This child is being babysat for when that adult comes and takes them away, right? So all you have to do is keep them safe until that adult arrives and they will take them from you and they'll know everything you did. Unlike the other parents that come and take away kids when you babysit. But that's part of the ayin tova, seeing the potential that's in them, seeing what they can be. The concept of a Swiss cheese person is that we're all created with holes on purpose, so to appreciate the holes as opportunities. The holes are places where we can grow. That's God's invitation to us to co-create. So he creates us with things that aren't finished, that we get a chance to work on. Then it turns out, it wasn't planned, but it should have been, we talked a lot about sex last week, so have the talk. A lot, not once. This is a regular talk, and it's not one talk, it's layers, you know, at different times, so that you have a clear ability to discuss things that matter with your children. And then 2 new tools, which are just like phrases that you can use, but everybody knows them, just reminding you that they're there. Gamze Yavor, this too shall pass, right? That's the famous inscription in King Solomon's ring. He wanted a ring. He liked puzzles. He spoke a lot in puzzles. So he asked somebody to make him a ring with an inscription that would make him happy when he's sad and sad when he's happy. So that was the inscription, this too shall pass. Right, so if you're having a great time, you know it's going to pass. That should make you sad. If you're having a terrible time, you know it should pass. That should make you happy. So this too shall pass. But it's an important thing, especially to keep in mind with teenagers. It's very easy to get into it with them. So this too shall pass. They will grow up, and they're going to be tons of fun. Just telling you from the other side of teenagers that they're so much fun when they're young adults. They're fabulous. I love it. Just love it. It's just a blast having kids where you're like, I know, I just saved a part of the Wall Street Journal this week for my son who just lost, over the summer, he lost like 50 pounds. Wow. So now that he lost 50 pounds, he wasn't fat before, but now he looks good, you know, like good. And he likes looking good. So he's bought some new clothes and he looks good. So you know, he's thin, so he bought a lot of thin profile things. But I saw in the Wall Street Journal, skinny's going out, a little more comfortable is coming in. Lower, no, but skinny clothes for men. Good. So I just saved the style section for him. So he should see, you know, but it's just fun as an adult to, like, I'm not buying those clothes, I'll buy some of them. But just, like, it's fun to, like, put that in his box and save, like, you know, little articles or things for him that are for him, that about his life.
Where do all his eyes at?
Right, for sure. I tell him long coats for men with color, very in. More important than the suit that's underneath the coat is the overcoat, turns out, this season for men.
How did he do it?
Camel hair coat's coming back and stuff.
Yeah, well, it's tan. It's not exactly color. Yeah, it's not color. No, plaid is even like really like long duster
that.
Coats. Like, yeah.
Like John Gotti.
So how did he do it?
I just put it in. I just
how
saved
did,
it. I'm just.
How did he lose
it? Oh. Math. Eat less.
Exercise.
You burn more calories than you consume.
Yeah, that's right. That's what if you ask him how he did it, he'll just say math. That's it. And he didn't even exercise very much. He just chose to be okay with being hungry for a while so that he would lose weight. So he was. So he looks great. Yeah. So thanks. Okay, so apropos of our discussion last week, I think we talked a little bit about, but I just wanted to remind you about touching. Right, so touching...
Wait, did you skip out this too?
Gamzulatova. Yeah, I did skip that one. Gamzulatova. Okay, so that's the other expression. This too is for the good. That phrase is based in a Gemara, the story of Rabbi Akiva, who was also called Ish Gamzu, the man of Gamzu, because he said Gamzulatova all the time. Oh, so really? He was traveling on the road. He had his donkey, his candle, and his rooster. And he was looking for a place to stay. And the village that he stopped at, nobody would allow him to stay there. You know, off into the forest he goes to sleep alone. He's pretty frustrated because it's not very nice. Like, people should be hospitable, and nobody was. So that night, he's in the forest. He has his candle, so he's learning some Torah, right? The wind comes and blows it out. And he doesn't have a match, so he can't relight it. He has to wait till he finds a stove to relight it somehow, or the fire, whatever it's out. Okay, there's no fire. He figures, okay, he's going to go to sleep. Then... he figures, well, he'll wake up early. He has the rooster. So then the rooster, I think, gets eaten by some animal.
Oh.
Yeah. And then he says, okay, no problem. So fine, I'll wake up when I wake up, but at least I have my donkey to help me carry my stuff, and the lion comes and eats his donkey, or something like that. Anyway, the next morning, he finds out that entire village was attacked and raided, and many people are dead and damaged, and he was fine because he was in the forest alone. If there would have been a fire, people would have seen him. If it would have been a rooster, people would have heard him. If it would have been a donkey, he would have brayed. So the fact that they all died was, this too is for the good. So he was, and he said that after each thing happened, this too is for the good. I just don't know how it's for the good. But in the morning he saw. That being said, we have this concept as Jews, this too is for the good, and we live with it. I listened to Rabbi Tauber on a lecture one time who said he was at the airport and he missed his flight and he thought, oh, sitting at the gate thinking, maybe the plane's going to crash and I'll see this too is for good. And he thought to himself, what? I need 300 people to die for it to be okay for me to miss my flight? I'd let them all land peacefully and healthfully and get to their, wherever they're going, said it's got to be good for some other reason. It doesn't have to be like that, right? Mm-hmm. But we do understand this too is for the good. That being said, when I did pay the Shiva call in Israel, so that is what Chaya Levine, the wife of Rabbi Kalman Levine, who was murdered, said that she totally trusts God that this is for the good.
Oh my gosh.
She says she does not want to be referred to as a victim of terror. She is not a victim. This is how God set up the world. Her husband was a tzaddik, which he really was. More than many people could have seen had he not died like this, people would not have known. Because who talks about things like that? But he's the kind of guy who slept 4 hours a night. He'd fall asleep on his books. His kids would wake him up. Dad, go to bed. Again, he'd learn a little bit till he fell asleep on his books. Dad, go to bed. 4 hours, basically. He would get up for the first possible time to pray. So he went to the minyan that's always adjusted so that it's the first one in the morning. And he said Shemona Esrei, that standing silent prayer, so long every day that he missed the whole rest of the prayer service. So he would finish saying Shemona Esrei and go to a second service to do the rest of the prayers every day. That's the kind of person he was. You know, like, that's not a normal kind of a person, but that's just how he lived his life. So nobody would know that if... Not that he needed to be killed for people to know that. They didn't. But that there are holy people living among us. He was one of them, for sure. And they live in a tiny little apartment. Their whole apartment is smaller than this room. I mean, that 11 people live in is smaller than this. They have a living room, dining room, and they have a tiny little kitchen, and they have 3 little bedrooms and 2 little bathrooms. And that's how they live. And 11 people. Well, 2 kids are married now.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's just people live differently than we live. But I've been there, and I've seen, you know, that's not so easy financially. But they're always besimcha. They're always happy. Like, they eat what they have, you know. So if they can't get every kind of fruit or vegetable, then they can't. But they're not hungry. They just don't have all the variety that, and they certainly don't have waste. Nothing gets thrown away, and, you know, like, it's all saved. So, but she was very, very clear that the world is changing, and this is part of the shift in the world, and Mashiach is definitely around the corner. And all the rabbis who came, I was there when the chief Sephardic rabbi came, and the chief Ashkenazic rabbi came, and Natan Sharansky came, and the parents of the three-month-old that was killed last month came to pay a Shiva call, among others. But pretty much all the rabbis, all the religious figures who came said, clearly, this is outside of the norm. This is not regular terrorism that we're used to already. This is not. This is
like
a shift in the way things are working.
Oh, yeah.
And because things are shifting. So so she felt that very strongly, and she felt God's kindness in the whole process, the Gamzu Latova, in the fact that her husband for the last several months had been teaching about God's justice. So that was the conversation in the household, was that God is always just and always good, even when it looks hard. So that had just been household conversation for months. And then she, when she came to America 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, for the conference that that I went to where she was there from Israel, so she flew out to California to visit a family, one of the Rebbetzins that we care for, whose son, I don't know if I mentioned, she has a two-year-old who drowned but didn't die. He's been in a coma for 4 months. So she prepared a whole class also on God's justice and dealing with difficulty and acceptance and handling things, which she gave in that situation. And so she said, see how nice God is that I had the opportunity to prepare for this? So, yeah. So that is somebody who's really on a level. So we should just know. But we can say Gamzu Latova. We don't have to. It's up to you if you want to make that a mantra in your life or not. But that is a Jewish thought that everything is for the good. I'll just go from Jewish heavy to movie light. But a line that I loved in the Marigold Hotel, Best Marigold Hotel,
oh, I love
it. Was our elders teach us, you know, it's always good in the end. And if it's not good, it's not yet the end. So it's good to know that it is always, it's going to be good. And if it's not good right now, it's not the end. Just wait. It's going to be good. It is. But there's definitely hard times in between now and the end. So hopefully the main hard times are over. Okay. Moving on to, yeah.
Did you see the other widows?
I did not go see the other ones because I was close
with her.
They're
very close. It's one shul.
Yeah, it's one shul. But I didn't go see them because she's my friend. I didn't just go to, like, a lot of strangers came because they felt like connection. So I'm sure they went to all four. But we're friends. I had to go see her, you know. Like,
oh, yeah. It's amazing you went.
Yeah, I had to. It was good that I went.
I'm sure she appreciated
it. Yeah, it was nice. She did say it's nice to have somebody who knows her and knew him. I didn't know him well, but I know her well. Just because everybody is saying what a tzaddik he was and how great he was, and he was. But she said, but who could I tell, like, how much he loved me? You know, and then he gave me foot massages. I'm like, you can't say that at a shiva where everybody's saying he learned so much and he was such a tzaddik. You know, like I could tell you that, and I'm really glad you're here to tell you that. So,
how do you know her?
She's my boss. Yeah, so I really met her. We were friendly for a few years before she hired me to, because she does the follow-up for all these Rebbetzins all around the world, but she wanted to hand over North America.
It's called Ner.
Ner La'elef. So she still does
just
Eastern.
Talking about that's who you were employed by when I was first talking to you about, like, the Jewish experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, no, you're employed by.
Right, Ner La'elef, right.
That's
so that's what I do.
For thousands.
Right. Light for thousands.
So, all over the world.
So my job is North America. She does the follow-up for women in Europe, South Africa, and Russia. So so we'll see. That her job means traveling. So we'll see what happens with that, too. She's going to have to rearrange lots of things. Okay. Touching. So we spoke a lot about sexuality last week, but I want to make sure I mention this. Touching. So touching, especially a hug, right, will help release oxytocin. So we talked about oxytocin, the cuddle hormone. It's a great hormone, very important, released when you're nursing, very important for parents to release towards their children, because it and spouses towards each other does get released in the sexual act too, because it makes you a little blind, right, which you need to be with spouses and kids. Right? That's what Benjamin Franklin said. You're supposed to go into a marriage with your eyes wide open and stay in it with them half shut. Oxytocin helps you keep your eyes half shut, right? You need that so that you don't see all the faults. So it's very important.
What faults?
Right, what faults? There's no faults to see, not in our kids and not in our spouses. Everything's fabulous. Yeah. So touching is very important and very risky because it blinds you. So if you engage in a lot of touching or sex before marriage, you can't see clearly. So that's important for your kids to know on both sides. Touching, and they're going to touch, but they just need to know it does take away your seichel. It takes away your ability to evaluate it intellectually. Right? So, which is what you want. After you've made an intellectual decision to engage in a relationship with this person, then it's good to have touching be there to help you not see all the stuff. But it's not good before you've made that decision. So it's important to have that conversation. You're not going to probably ask your kids, that's up to you. But in general, most people aren't asking their kids to not touch for that reason. Nevertheless, you might just want to let them know how important touching is and what it does so that they could hear other people in their lives. If other people are saying, he's really not good for you, she's not up, you know, she's not the right one for you, they need to be able to listen to that because they need to know they've blinded themselves through the touching. And that people who are close to them, close friends, parents, siblings, can sometimes reflect truths that they might not be able to see because they've engaged in touching. So touching, whether it's all the way sexual or even not, even hugging. Even if you've hugged once in a while and you like that person a lot, when you see them without touching them, they just walk into the room, you see your spouse, they walk into the room, you get a little like, oh, that's nice they're here, right? That's a little oxytocin release right there, right? So if you've primed the pump with some touching, you don't even have to touch for that to happen. So that's important for our kids to know in terms of their relationships, and it's important for us to know in terms of our relationships with them. Fathers, hug your daughters. Very, very important. Very important for parents to touch their children a lot, and particularly important for fathers to give their daughters a lot of physical, healthy physical attention. You're so beautiful. I love you. Here's a big hug. Whatever it is, just a brush on the back. But that touch is very important because if they don't get it from a kosher male, they're going to just seek it somewhere else. So it's important. Girls need to have male attention. They want to be beautiful and they want somebody to notice that and to feel loved. Feel loved. So they need to feel it in their guts and they need to feel it on their body. And they'll look for it in other places if they don't have that emotional feeling and physical feeling. They'll look for it anyway. It's developmentally appropriate as they get older, but you can help them seek more appropriate partners by expressing more love towards them, physical love towards them.
More than mothers hugging themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Because the girls are the ones who are seeking it from the guys. The guys are... The girls are more the relationship creatures. I mean, it depends, but it's important. Everybody needs hugs. And that's one reason why you want to consider very carefully before you send a kid away to a dorm school where they don't get hugs. You know, you send them away for high school. Oh. High school, I'm saying. People who send their kids away for high school, lots of stuff happened in the high schools that is not always the healthiest because they are not getting those parental hugs and touches. Because you do. You need to be touched. So you need to be touched in healthy ways.
But then Orthodox send to yeshiva so early, and I wonder what about it feels so early.
That's what I'm saying. It's a problem. It's not always so healthy in a dorm, not even in a yeshiva dorm. Stuff happens.
It's too early.
Yeah, it is too early.
Like 18 is too early.
18 is probably not too early, but 14 is too early.
You go to the army, how is that too early?
18, yeah. Well, just because you go to the army isn't That's necessarily a good thing. You get to go to the army before you can even drink legally. Which is probably smart, but not really fair.
19 in the Orthodox world, you're getting married, though.
Right. Right. So, I mean, the truth is, usually it's the girls who are 19, the boys are a little bit older. But if you went to a gender-separate school, so half of your energy in high school is spent trying to attract the guys. Really. Fully half of your time is on that, right? If you take all of that energy and turn it towards you, because you're in a school where there are no guys, plus you're being taught, don't start broadcasting. You're not a broadcaster yet. It's not okay, right? So all that energy goes in. Really, you're already 22 by the time you're 19, you know? So you've already done a lot of growing, and you know where you're headed, a lot of it, Not all of it, but there's a lot. So you are a little older by 19 than a regular 19-year-old is, because she wasted so much of her energy, or she dissipated so much of her energy on, you know, other stuff. So, right, okay, so touching. Touching is very important for kids to know about and very important for parents to know about. Touching is important. So to engage in it and to warn your kids about it.
Some cultures touch more than others. Uh-huh. My parents are from Germany, so they do not touch so much.
Right.
But then Chile is the opposite of Germany, so everyone kisses.
Yeah, and they kiss twice, right? Does Chile kiss them both?
Chile is stingy, only one. Mm-hmm. But my sisters-in-law, France and Belgium, one is two and one is three. So I'm stingy for them, but I'm generous for America. That is zero kisses. Right.
So
it's very interesting to to see different countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting.
Reserved versus outgoing.
Right, right. America's a touchy place in general, I think. Mm. Maybe not so kissy, but it's touchy.
No, it's more distance. When I get into the plane to Chile or Israel, everything changes. I get closer to people that I don't know. Mm-hmm. And it's much more. Mm. It's very fascinating, actually. In the airport already, I have to switch.
Yeah, it is fascinating.
And then I come back and I have to go back. Compared to Europe, you're right. We're warm here compared to Europe. I don't know about Asia.
Me either.
Reserved, I think.
Okay, well, let's move to sleep. So just to be aware of sleep and that teens don't get enough, period. End of discussion. They do not. They're chronically sleep deprived. You have to know that as a parent who has children who are driving, that they are chronically and eternally sleep-deprived. Our society does not give them enough time, and we don't give them enough time. Should they be binge-sleeping on the weekends? The jury's out on that. Some people say, yes, they just need to catch up, and you can refill your batteries by doing that. And some people say, it confuses your body. They shouldn't be sleeping till noon, but they should definitely be sleeping till later, because you can repay some sleep. Those are all things, but, I mean, so you have to figure that out in life, what you want to do with that. But the research does seem to show that sleep, just like sleep before a test is important so that you will have clarity of thought, sleep after learning something is very important, because that's how you lay down the information from your short-term memory into your long-term memory. It transfers during a good long sleep. That's true for adults and true for kids. The Army did some of that research, but in the Army, when people are taught, when they anyway keep you sleep-deprived, but if you've been taught just how to operate some machinery, that night you get 8 hours. Because you need to remember that. And so they're putting the science to work for them. So that's just an important thing to know, too. If your kids are learning something important, or if you're learning something important, make sure you sleep well that night. Make the time for it. Go to bed earlier, or whatever it is, because sleeping is vital.
Did you hear?
Very difficult.
Well, it's amazing the moods you can see your kids
get
to sleep versus when they don't.
Their
eating habits, their moods, their
absolutely
everything.
Absolutely.
Smiles, you know.
Absolutely. Armor. And even the ability to pay attention. Many times ADD could be misdiagnosed. It's really sleep deprivation, which responds very nicely, it turns out, to uppers. So, uppers.
Pills.
To pills. To those kinds of pills. The pills that you take for ADD, which is necessary for ADD, is the same pills that give you, it's just extra caffeine, basically. You're highly caffeinated. The high caffeine for somebody with ADD helps the ADD person put on the brakes so that they can focus better on things and not be so impulsive. But that high caffeine also wakes up somebody who's sleepy. So if you're sleep deprived and for that reason you're scattered and can't focus on things, right? So all you need is that big dose of caffeine and you're in, right? So that's why kids in college want it, buy it, you know.
You buy the ADD pills?
Yes.
They buy it from their friends.
They're like that no-dose, I remember.
When we were in college,
Jolt, soda. Why don't I just drink coffee?
It's not. It's much better than
Jolt.
Coffee.
5-hour energy drinks, they're all
Twinkies. Yeah.
Right, right.
Oh, my God.
Right.
So
Jolt and Twinkies.
Jolt and Twinkies.
It works for the fine.
Jolt.
Yeah. 6-pack of Jolt.
You don't make that
Twinkies.
Anymore. Do
you? That is.
When I was in residency, one of the guys didn't drink coffee. He drank a Jolt in the morning. That worked.
Wow. It's like extra
Jolt
caffeine.
Jolt is coffee,
in soda.
Though. It's not. Yeah.
It's super, super.
It's just super amounts of caffeine in soda with a lot of sugar.
Yeah. But I have a friend who's in his
70s. After the final, you can't fall asleep.
Right. Of course
that
not.
That doesn't work.
You're just up all day,
And you're like, oh, feeling so bad.
Yeah, I have a friend in his 70s who was in college. He was getting his MBA at the same time that he was doing his ordination.
In his 70s? Or
he is now in his
70s. I thought you were saying he was doing that.
Wow. He is now in his 70s. But when he was getting his MBA and doing his ordination at the same time, it was a lot, you know, and he's a smart guy, but it was a... So he went to the pharmacy to buy some no-dos, and the pharmacist said to him, let me show you something that's a little better than that. He said, and that's what I learned about amphetamines. Because the pharmacist at that time gave it to him.
What?
This is 50 years ago, so yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So yeah. I don't think he uses it now, but he definitely uses that blessing. Anyway, so sleep, very important. So, and if you have moody kids, that would be something to work with them on gently. They could be so moody they don't want to work with you on it. Mm-hmm. That's a hard thing too.
They want to close the computer.
Right, but that's a real challenge. But that's definitely something just to keep in mind, how important sleep is for you too.
Yeah, and the pediatrician just told us like an hour before the computers have to be off.
Yeah,
because you think the kids slept 9 hours, but the first hour was not sleep. I mean, they're
right because they're still processing,
but it's not starting the sleep cycle. But go convince them to shut their computer before they go to sleep. That's
right. So your kids are too old for that. Your kids could maybe still be trained for that, but yeah, and we ourselves too, you know, and it's up to, we have to also try that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not so easy.
For kids, 9 hours, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for teenagers, yeah.
We're hoping for six.
Yeah, right.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah,
seven.
Yeah. Yeah. Adults need between 7 and 9. And most adults need in the 8 range.
Yeah.
And most adults, because they've heard 7 to 9, think I only need 7.
Yeah, but then you're
so they only sleep 6. But you need 8, and right. Some adults need 9.
I need 9.
Right, and your term said if you do 7, intellectual capacity goes down.
It does. It diminishes. It does. Okay, now let's move to brain development, which is why I brought you that article. Just there, I watched a couple of TED Talks today. It was interesting, and read some other articles on brain development. But it was interesting just to hear. There's something, it was on NPR, it was broadcast, and I only heard part of it today, but I looked up the book. And what is it called now? Well, Work in Progress. Just talking about the adolescent brain. So the way they defined adolescence in that news article was from the onset of puberty, whenever that is, 11, 12-ish, 11 in girls, 12 in boys, approximately, until independence. 30? Right? Until they're making meaningful contributions to society and living independent lives. That's how they defined it. Right? So, but really they're saying 25-ish. So it could be 15 years, really. 14, 15 years is adolescence. But it's also, I mean, brain science is confirming that too, that your brain is still growing and your ability to make good decisions is still growing, particularly into your early 20s. The risk, so that's what I wrote down here, the risk-benefit proportion. So risk-taking, they're less risk-averse, and also they see the benefits as bigger than we do.
Say that again.
They're both less risk-averse. They don't mind taking a risk. You know, jump 2 feet and then see what it feels like after that. You'll figure it out.
Yeah, the cast now for 2 months.
Right. So that's the risk. They're not so worried about risk like we are, like I am now that I fell in the ice 2 years ago. I walk carefully in the ice. I'm risk averse, right? I'll rather hold on to the car. Like, I don't want to fall like that again. It still hurts today, right? So I'm risk averse in that sense, physically risk averse. So I'll drive more carefully. I'll wait until there's a nice big window before I turn into traffic. I don't want to just scoot in, you know, like I like space to change lanes. So I'm risk averse that way. And then the benefit proportion, right? So how important is the benefit? So if you remember back to your high school days or middle school days, that first puppy love is so amazing. Very different than the amazingness in college or middle adulthood, right? That first, like, it's so special. All these little things that were so important, you know, are today we look at them and we're like, really? You know, even a good meal, like, it's nice, but are you going to go out on a cold night for that? So you'll have popcorn and cereal instead of like going for something like gourmet because it's cold out after all. Like whatever it is, like we just have different understandings of the risks we're willing to take for the benefit that we're going to gain. So they see bigger benefit in smaller packages, but big benefit, and they see they're not so worried about risk. And that is just part of how their brain is wired. So that's important to know about them. So that's just important in terms of boundaries and and lectures and constant retalking about things and letting them know about risks and all that stuff. But setting up those kinds of, having the regular conversations about the risks that are inherent in this and the benefits that are there, and being able to put off, I mean, one of the definitions of maturity is the ability to put off a short-term benefit for a long-term goal. So talking to them about that too, can they do that? You know, commonly today referred to as the marshmallow test. You know, I'll give you a marshmallow, and if you don't eat it for 5 minutes, I did this, I think, with 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds. I'll give you a marshmallow. If you don't eat it for 5 minutes, I'll give you a second one. Can they hold that marshmallow in their hand for 5 whole minutes and get a second one or not? So they followed these 3-4-year-olds over a longitudinal study, and the ones who could did better in life. The ones who could wait. So is that something trained? I don't know. Is that something inherent? Maybe. Nevertheless, at least those kinds of conversations, you know, let's look at the benefit here, let's look at the benefit there, let's see which benefit we want to get, let's see how we're going to get there. And having conversations like that on a regular basis is important, whether it's, you know, a straight risk-benefit conversation or just, you know, I encourage you to keep running, you know, you really want to do that, you know, you want to go from the half marathon to the whole marathon, and if you, even though it's cold today, if you run again, you're going to make it, you'll see. That's also just those kinds of conversations.
So the question, if pretty much teens are wired this way, and we just kind of have to hold on for the ride, I mean, what are we doing?
Okay, they are wired this way and not. So that's what the brain science today is showing, is that their brains are very flexible, so that it's definitely time to work with them. So they are wired this way, but they're still growing. So you can still instill things in them. So the old paradigm, before we were able to watch all these functional MRIs and that kind of thing and see what's going on, is that basically most of the growth is done between 1 and 3. So the importance of early intervention, you know, and catching things as early as possible, working them with them, OT at a very young age, all that stuff. And that if you don't get it early, and hence the Head Start programs, all that stuff that you want to get as early as possible. But it turns out that there's another burst of development right around puberty. And then your gray matter actually decreases from, like, let's say 12, 13 till 20. So it is growing and then it starts to decrease. Now, you might think the decrease is something to worry about, but according to the things I read and watched today, it's not. That's actually called pruning, synaptic pruning. And that's very important, to have the pruning process where you've learned a lot of things and then you do have to shut down the things that are just getting in the way, like pruning a rose bush. You don't want to grow that way, so prune it so all the plant's energy can go in the direction that you want. So our brains do some of that synaptic pruning, which means that it's very important what they do during puberty. You know, if they're couch potatoes, they're going to be pruning their hard work parts. You know, and if they're really working on music, then they're going to be growing in music and pruning their laziness parts. Right? So whatever it is, you do want to try to, that's why it's important as the parent of a teen, is that there is this synaptic pruning going on and there is some growth still going on, and you certainly want to protect them. So while they're less trustworthy for their own selves, right? So there's all that. So that's why we need to know about it. But yes, there's definitely, so we definitely want to encourage them. Things that are laid down at a young age stick. Those are important things. So we definitely want to.
My hope is that they always will just hear that chatter in their head when it comes to the point where they have to make those decisions.
Right. So the chatter is important to put in there. But that's why I printed out the article, and I do encourage you to just do a little more research on what we're learning about brains and how they work. We're still so in the beginning of understanding brains and how they work. Nevertheless, we know a little more than we used to know. Doesn't mean we're going to parent differently. It doesn't so much, but because in the end of almost everything that I watched and read today, it said basically what your grandmother was doing is the right thing and keep doing that. Right, but you do want to, so that means good nutrition, good sleep, be polite. So that's what our grandmothers did, not so much our parent. Like, so we have to kind of get back to the really traditional, like, you know, all that stuff. Good sleep habits and good hygiene habits and good, you know, whatever it is, because that is what lays down a foundation and that it sticks, it seems. Which brings us to expectations. Expectations are, I mean, so this is sort of just adding a layer and review. I do want to focus on the Friday night blessing stuff. So expectations, just having high expectations is so important. You know, just because it does call you forth to have people around you expecting things from you. So that does help. And I think today it's such a challenging time to raise teens because really it's a bigger generation gap than ever. I think everybody thinks that, but I think it really is now because of all the gadgets. You know, because of all the social media. It's such a different world that it's not a one generation gap, it's a several generation gap in one family. And you really are living in parallel universes that you can't really understand each other. So I can't help you with that. All I can say is good luck to you on that one. But it's something to know about. But we still can have strong expectations and still try to figure out some boundaries. But we can't put boundaries on all that social stuff because that's their world. It is where they live. And we have to respect that, too. That's their environment. So we want to help learn as much as we can about the environment so that we can help them navigate it. Because that's our job, help them learn how to become independent in the environment that they are going to live in. So
we have to learn the gadget.
Yeah, you do. Just like you can't raise your children with Brazilian style parenting or ethics in America or South African, right? It's different. Of course you're going to bring things from your past. Oh, sorry, Chile. Sorry. With Chilean style or German, right?
Sorry, Israel.
Or Israel. It's different, and America is a different place. You have to learn the culture of here to be able to help them navigate here. You could choose not to or be incapable of it. That's a lot of immigrant parents can't. So they can't then teach their children how to navigate their life in this country. So the same thing with social media. If you can't learn something about it, you won't be able to help them learn how to navigate themselves in it. You'll be able to give them other skills, which hopefully they will be able to apply, but you won't be able to directly help them learn how to navigate inside that world if you don't know anything about it. So that's just the reality of it. If you don't know about the environment, you can't help them inside it. So it doesn't mean you can't give them other important things, but you won't be able to give them that. Okay, and then to remember that really what's happening right now is separation and launch. It's a long process, but that's separation is totally normal. This is the terrible twos on steroids, right? That's their job, is to not be you. And that means they're healthy. I know. That's what I tell my husband. I want to be patient, and I want it now. Why should it take so long for me to learn patience? I don't understand it. yeah, you do want them. But we're trying to launch them. We don't want the failure to launch. We want them to have healthy lives where they're separate from us and where we can really enjoy the separateness and enjoy who they are, even if they choose lives that are different than ours, and hopefully they will. I had the cutest little thing. I mean, you probably don't think it's so little, but a 27-year-old, he's very cute, knocked on my door. He's circulating a petition. He's going to be opening Gathering Grounds, a new cafe on Colfax and Yate. They're going to do one Southeast, too. It's a board game cafe where people get together to play board games. He wants a liquor license. It's not going to be a bar, but just to like make it social, and will I sign a petition? And he also wants to make it kosher. So it's cold outside. I asked him to step inside once I hear, you know, like, see he's a Jewish guy. Talk to him. And he's just like so cute. And as I'm looking at him, the same age as one son that I have, but he wants a beer license. And I have one son, my 24-year-old, totally into craft beers. He knows like all the breweries in Colorado and what they do and all their methods and German purity standards and blah, 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 and all the how to pair a beer with a meal. You know, if it should be light and fluffy, if it should be dark and rich, if it should be, you know, all these. I don't know all this stuff. He does. So I want to introduce him to my sons. Like, you know, just for, like, he's married, but they all have nice conversation, you know. Like, so I told him, in our neighborhood, don't bother going kosher. Because our Jews in this neighborhood, they don't have money, and they don't like to have fun. Like, you're just wasting your kosher place on us. Make it fun, but make it good, because it's yuppifying. But don't, like, if it's expensive to be kosher, I'd love it to be kosher, but if it's expensive, it's not worth it on the West Side.
To play the board games would be expensive?
No,
the kosher supervision is very expensive.
But I think the one on the side.
I said, yeah, so I said...
across from the high school.
Oh, right. Yeah. So I said the one down south, I said those Jews do have money and they like to have fun. So that's worth it. Then you're going to get people who keep kosher who want a place like that.
But they have an Okinawa
Sakamano. But I saw a sign the bagel place is going in there too. Somebody told me.
Well, it's the same person.
The one from the bagel.
Right. Yeah.
She's but if you do it without beer, just the board games, there's no need for machine.
Food, no, they want food.
No food. No,
they want to serve food.
Yeah. Sandwiches.
It's for the food, to make it a cafe.
Where 7-Eleven is.
Yeah.
Around the corner.
And the drive-in.
Aces Union. It's on Union.
Yeah, where the cupcakes were.
Yes.
Exactly.
Flower pot and the yogurt.
Mm-hmm. Right. Anyway, it's fun having little adults that are yours. That aren't yours, but that you raised, and you can have a lot of fun with. Okay, now I want to move into looking at the Friday night lesson a little bit, because we did say we try to end on time, but I think this is a very important thing. I don't know if anybody has the custom to bless their children Friday night,
but
if you do, that's great, so I want to give you a little depth in it, and if you don't, I would encourage you, even if you don't do Friday night meals, to pick a time to bless your kids on a weekly basis or on a semi-regular basis at some point. It's such a nice thing. So this is the, just encouraging you. Of course, you'll do what you want. But just to note, this is the priestly blessing that's in the Torah. It's right here in Numbers 6, 24 to 26. The priests, the Kohanim, when they bless us, their blessing that they say before they bless us, because it's a positive commandment for them to do it. So you say a blessing on a commandment, just like we say, Asher Kedshanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu Ladlik Ner Shel Chanukah. They say, Asher Kedshanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu Livarech Et Amo Yisrael, to bless the nation of Israel, Bi'ahava, to bless them with love. So what does that mean? That they should feel love while they give the blessing, or that the blessing is love? So I'm going to teach you Rabbi David Foreman's interpretation that the blessing itself is three different kinds of love and that you're blessing them with love. So let's just look first. When we get blessed by the Kohanim, what these three stages mean, and I have the Hebrew here on the side and the English, you can just see in the same verses. So the it's three words, five words, seven words. It's a very interesting blessing. There's lots to learn in it. But the first one is, God should bless you and keep you. So the understanding, and I'm just going to go quickly this way, this is how we are hoping that God will bless us, but that God will give us blessing and guard it. So that's material. This is for material blessing. That he increases that which we have in our lives. And that's why I wrote under here, bet, resh, chaf, that's the root of the word bracha. Bet and Resh and Chaf are all the first twos in their number categories. If you know about Gematria, that each letter has a numerical value. So Bet is number 2, and Resh is 200, and Chaf is 20. That's why I wrote there 2, 220, that it's 2, 2, 2, because that's the beginning of plural. Plural is the flow. Baruch, blessing, is a flow we want to flow. It's also the same root as Brecha, a pool that flows. Use that for a swimming pool, but it's for brecha, it's something that flows, so we want to flow. So really, this for God towards us is we're saying, please bless us materially and protect it. Once we've been blessed, we need, and that the bless is increase our stuff, right? That's the bet resh chaf, increase our stuff. And vishmarecha, and guard it. Once I have stuff, I need it guarded. I don't want somebody to take it away from me, or it should be a liability. I need to be guarded with that stuff. The second one, Ya'er Hashem panav elecha v'yichuneka, that he should cause his face to shine upon us and be gracious to us. That's chen. Graciousness is chen. That's spiritual blessing. That light, that he should shine his face upon us. That's giving us spiritual blessing. And give us chen, that we should have favor in the eyes of others. They should look upon us kindly, because there's no point in any blessing. You can't go anywhere with it if you don't have good relationships with other people, if they don't see you in a pleasant light. So that's the chen. And then third is the shalom, that Hashem should lift up his face towards you and grant you peace. You need peace between the physical and the spiritual. Neither one should be out of balance. You want them to be in balance, to have that peace in your life where you have enough physical to accomplish the spiritual, but it doesn't get in your way, and you have enough spiritual drive to be able to use your physical properly so that they both stay in balance, that you can use them both. So that's God towards us. But Rabbi Foreman says, this is really the parenting manual of the Torah, if you understand it best. That this is, in a nutshell, how to parent your children. That the first aspect of parenting your children is this first line. It's our job to increase them, to grow them, and to protect them. Certainly in the first stages of parenting, it starts in the womb, and the womb itself is all about increasing them, growing them, and protecting them. So the first fundamental aspect of parenting your children is to make them bigger and protect them. Right? So Baruch is the Yivarechecha, that they should be increased, and Yivishmerecha, that they should be protected. And he says those two words together, when you understand them together, equals rachamim. Rachamim, we say it's a rachmanis, you've probably heard that word before. Rachamim means mercy or compassion. So compassion is a kind of caring for somebody when you have an agenda. You want them to get better, even if it's just for them, but you have an agenda. It's not agenda-free. You want to give to them. You want them to grow. You want them to be good. You want them to be healthy. That's a compassionate kind of giving. And he says the root of the word compassion of rachamim is womb, is rechem, which is womb. So the rechem, it's interesting, on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we ask God to get off his chair of justice, his throne of justice, and move over to his throne of rachamim, rechem, and judge us from there. Because we don't really want to be judged with justice, because maybe we didn't do enough. Like, maybe we're nervous about that, and so we'd rather be judged from rachamim. So they ask two different questions. Justice asks, what have you done? And that can be a heavy question, because maybe you didn't do enough, or maybe you did something you shouldn't have. Rachamim doesn't ask that question. Because the question of the womb can't be what have you done, because you've done nothing, right? Just a little zygote presenting itself to the womb, and the womb has to ask, should I allow you to embed yourself in me and I'll give you everything? So the womb asks the question, who can you become? Right? It's a real question, but it's based in the future, not in the past. Right? It's how can I grow you? Are you worth me investing in you? That's the question of rachamim. So the first aspect of parenting is, may I be able to increase you and grow you, see who you could become, give you the tools that you need, and protect you. Right? So that's aspect number one of parenting, is increase them, grow them, and protect them. Then comes number two. Right, so the second two actually both have face in them, whereas the first one doesn't. In the womb, where the whole process starts, you don't see the mother's face. You don't see the parent's face. There is no face shining upon. It's a process of protection and growth that is faceless, really. But then, after you're born, so then you have the first aspect of, may God shine his face upon you, or may the parent then look down upon you and say, you're the cutest little thing. Chein vichuneka. The chein love is the love of unconditional love. I just think you're the most delicious little creature on the planet. Right? And it's hard to feel that sometimes for teenagers and teenagers, but we do sometimes have those moments. And certainly if you have a picture, one of the tools I use is a cute picture of my kid on the fridge, even if it's a younger picture, but have something cute you can look at to remind you how much you love them, even when they're being really difficult. So you see something that where you get that feeling of that little oxytocin release of, you're the cutest little thing, I love you, right? That's chein. But it's chein, that cutest little thing is a top-down look, right? That's not how we look at our spouses, you know, to say they're the cutest little thing, right? We don't want that. We want a peer relationship. But for our kids, there is that looking down at them, that gaze of love, whether they're in our arms or still in our purview. But that still is a top-down parental love. The delight, the love of delight, gazing down at them. But the third one is God should lift up his face, right? So Rashi says, why do we need that? Because we make decisions that anger God. And when you get angry, you turn your face away, right? And you don't want to look at somebody if you're mad at them. So we say, God, even if we've sinned against you, please lift up your face and give us peace. Please take us back, right? So with kids, they can make decisions and go places you don't necessarily want them to go. And this really is the third stage of parenting, is the ability to reconcile that they are their own people. and you'll lift up your face towards them, so that it's the gaze of peers, where you see them eye to eye. You're not any longer looking down upon them with graciousness, but looking at them directly with shalom. We've created a balance of, I get it, it's your life and you get to lead it, and I respect that, and I still love you for who you are, even if you've made decisions that I don't necessarily agree with, but you're somebody I want in my life, and I love you. And it's a direct gaze of lifting your face up and looking at them and giving them the gift of independence and love, even when they make decisions that you don't necessarily like, to be able to be there with them.
One of my kids the other day, I said, I know we think differently, and difference not bad. I said, there's so many people, if we're all the same, we'd all be doctors, we'd all be rabbis, mm-hmm. we'd all be this. But I said, it's not bad. I said, and I know I get frustrated because you think so differently than how I do, but it's just, we're going to come together
right.
at some point, and I still love you, even though I get frustrated.
Right. So that's what this shalom is. So Rabbi Foreman recommends, when blessing the child, what he says he likes to do is just actually think that moment when he has his hands on their head. He thinks for a minute, which kind of love does this child need right now? As I say this blessing, and I'm able to channel energy into the world, onto this child, you know, which is the love that I want to focus on that child needs from me right now? Is it the bracha and shmira, the blessing and guarding, or is it the chayin, the unconditional love, because they're in that place where they just need that food for growth of I love you no matter what? Or is it the shalom that I've made peace with who you are and who we are as in this relationship? And it's not just fine, but I've made peace with it, and I offer you peace in our relationship. Look, what does this kid need right now? How can I offer that to them?
So this theory is by Rabbi Foreman?
Rabbi David Foreman, Foreman.
He's from Israel?
No, he's from America. He does a lot of really interesting stuff. He has something called the Aleph Beta Academy. Short little videos on all kinds of... Aleph Beta Academy. And he has great stuff online. 10-minute videos on the Parsha, on all kinds of deep concepts. So this is one of the Parshiot that he just discusses. Like he says, raising kids, one of the most important things we do. You'd think the Torah would have something to say on it, but there's not really a lot. He says, actually, I think there is. He says, these three verses is something you can carry with you everywhere to understand the essence of parenting is to help them increase and guard them, give them unconditional love, and make peace with them as they grow. And if you understand that deeply, that is your parenting paradigm for what you're really supposed to be accomplishing with them. The rest is, there's lots of details, but the depth of what you're supposed to be accomplishing is helping them grow, guarding them, giving them unconditional love, and then making peace with who they become.
That's
beautiful. So that's what I want to share with you, and that's the end
that's
of our
amazing.
Parenting Paradigm series.
Well, I'm sure there's and, much more.
So much to learn and grow, but we should... Oh, that's what I want to say at the end. Okay, the end is Mazal Tov, okay? Mazal Tov is our own blessing. Now I want to give you a blessing. Mazal Tov actually means a good flow. That's what it really means. It doesn't mean congratulations. We have an understanding that there is energy that flows into the world, and when people have a baby or a birthday or whatever it is, we say, what we're really saying when we say Mazal Tov is, may the energy flow for you, through you, to you in positive ways. That's what Mazal Tov means. So may you all have good energy flowing to you and through you in your homes, in your marriages, and in your parenting.
Thank you. Beautiful.